So the first thing we can do with it is just imagine we have a circuit that has only good extended rectangles. Okay? And then we can just directly apply this correctness condition to show that it's equivalent to an ideal circuit. That's really very easy to do. So let's look at a complete circuit. Well, it'll look something like this. We'll have state preparations at the beginning, and then we'll do a bunch of fault-tolerant gates with error corrections in between them, of course. And then at the end, we'll do some measurements. Okay? And so now, just as an illustration, let's assume that all of these extended rectangles are correct, are good. So what that means is, well, since they're good, they're correct. So in particular, we can start at the end with this measurement extended rectangle and apply the correctness. And apply the correctness condition for measurement extended rectangles. And what that says is we can insert an ideal decoder. Okay? So this is equivalent to this. Right, where this is ideal. Okay? And then, well, we have a gate extended rectangle followed by an ideal decoder. So we can apply the correctness condition to that to say this is equal to this, where both of these are ideal. Okay? And we do this through all the gate extended rectangles. And then we're left with preparation extended rectangles followed by ideal decoder, which we can again apply the preparation correctness condition to get this. Preparation, gates, measurement. And all of these are ideal. Okay? So what we've proven is that if we have a circuit, fault-tolerant circuit, consisting only of good extended rectangles, that's equivalent, I mean, by equivalent, I mean actually equal as a CPGB map, which means it gives some. So the outcome of this is some bit string, right? The outcomes of the measurements. And so what's going to happen is this ideal circuit at the end gives the same distribution of bit strings as outcome, as the fault-tolerant circuit. Okay? So if only we had a situation where all of the extended rectangles were good, we'd be done. We'd know that the circuit behaved as we wanted to. Right? Everyone sees this? Okay. So but what about bad rectangles? Bad extended rectangles. So what we'd like, so kind of the sensible thing, is we say, well, we can move the ideal decoder through a good extended rectangle and replace the fault-tolerant gate by an ideal gate. So what would be sensible is we say, well, a bad extended rectangle, we could move an ideal decoder through it and replace the fault-tolerant gate, well, by a decoded gate, but it would be a gate with an error, right? Because we don't expect the bad extended rectangles to behave correctly. So we'd have something like this. And this is just something I made up to represent a gate with an error. Okay? Unfortunately, it turns out this actually isn't even true. And the reason it's not true Well, you can do this to a certain extent. But the problem is that the error in the decoded gate depends on information that's been lost. And in particular, it depends on, so it's okay that it depends on errors in this segment. Okay? That would still allow us to sensibly say that these two are equal as quantum operations. But the problem is that it actually depends on the syndrome of the incoming state. Okay, so for instance, let's say for the 7-qubit code, there's one bit flip error and one phase error in the X-ray. Okay, so if the incoming syndrome is zero, then there's no error, right? Because the error correction circuit for the 7-qubit code can correct one bit flip error and one phase error. But if the syndrome in the incoming qubit is a bit flip, then the gate has a bit flip error. And if it's a phase flip, then the gate has phase error. Okay. So this is maybe not a complete example because you need some way for it to these errors to get through this error correction stuff. But it's a bad error correction, right? So there could be errors in the error correction stuff that prevent the previous errors from being seen, right? It cancels the anomaly and so on. Okay. But the point is that at the end of the day here is that to know what error occurred here, you have to know what the syndrome is in the incoming state. And this picture doesn't have anything that tells you what that syndrome is. Right? Because that syndrome information was thrown away when we had the ideal decoder. Does everyone understand the problem?
Actually, no. Can't we already say something about the fault-tolerant circuit?
We can say a lot about the fault-tolerant circuit. The problem is that this is a bad rectangle. So the fault-tolerant properties that we defined before don't apply anymore, because they all were limited to the case where the total number of errors was less than or equal to t.
Right.
Which isn't necessarily true in this case.
Yeah, so it's not, but...
I am leading up to concatenation, but not with this example.
Not with this one. So then I don't get the point. I don't see what you're trying to.
So is the problem you don't see what I want to do?
Yeah.
Or you don't see what the problem is?
Yeah, I don't see what
okay.
I want to
so
do.
What I'd like to be able to do, I mean, so yes, so in that case, I am leading up to concatenation. The point is, I'd like to take a big circuit that has some good extended rectangles, some bad extended rectangles, and I'd like to go backwards from what I did before and replace it by a decoded circuit where the good extended rectangles are replaced by correct gates that do the ideal gates, and bad extended rectangles are replaced by faulty gates. Okay? And the motivation for doing this, of course, is that I expect the rate of having bad rectangles is going to be lower than the rate of having bad single unencoded gates in the original physical error model. I'm going to show that next. But in order to do it at all, I have to have some way of replacing these bad extended rectangles by unencoded gates. And the problem is that doing that depends on information that kind of would disappear when you do this decoding to know where the errors are.
So also at this just at this point, we would probably be able to recover Shaw's original result, right? About fault tolerant circuits that.
Yeah, so Shor's original result basically only need to go up to here, right?
Right.
So you have to do some statement about what's the probability of having a bad extended rectangle.
That's right.
But if you have all good extended rectangles, then you get the ideal circuit. So you just have to calculate then what the probability of having all good. And that was Shor's original result. Yeah.
So Daniel, as you said, right, that the errors that are caused are not, I mean, since they can be correlated within time steps,
mm-hmm.
They are not necessarily, they don't look like CBTP only on the circuit.
Right.
Right. So, but then still, they be correct. So, which means that our error correction code was working for them also. But,
yes.
Well,
so you remember that,
But then that's correct because the error correction code was working for all linear operations.
That's right.
Just,
yes.
So we're kind of crucially using it.
That's right. That's true. Very, very, very true. Yeah.
So to try to understand this, why I can't move the idea decoder through the bad gate, through a bad extract.
Yeah.
So this would be equal, but then I don't know what that bad gate is, right? So that's that. So for a particular
that's right.
bad gate,
that's right.
This would be equal.
So actually it's a little more subtle than that. So the point is I want these things represent quantum operations, right? And I want these to be equal as quantum operations. So if I know what the sync of is of the incoming state here, then I know how to do this connection. But I want this to be true for all states, right? And this operation should act on all states. Okay? So I can't ask for the synchron, I can't go back to the beginning and ask for the synchronous here. I have to have it still sitting around to use. Okay, and that's actually the solution. We have to have it sitting around somehow, but the ideal decoder extracts a syncum and then it throws it away, right? So we just don't throw it away. So we introduce something called the star encoder, or star decoder, I should say. And the star decoder is going to keep the syncum. So I'm going to draw it this way. It's going to have two outputs, and this one down here is the syncum. Okay? And of course, if we take the star decoder, and then we take the syncum and we throw it away, that's equal to just the ideal decoder. So what happens if you apply the star decoder to that picture up there? Well, it's going to work pretty easily. In fact, we're going to do something even a little bigger, a little different. So this star decoder is actually a unitary map, right? It's not losing any information at all. So it's convenient to insert both a star decoder and a star encoder at the beginning here. So we're actually going to be pushing this all the way back through not just to the original first error correction, but past it, and get rid of that too. Okay, so we'll put the star encoder and star decoder up here at the front. And so we have a star decoder followed by something. These two are, since this is unitary, this is inverse. So that's just the identity. And so what this is equal to is a star decoder followed by, well, the original gate, but with an error on it that depends on the synchron and the physical errors that occurred here. And then maybe the synchron gets modified some. But then we have the output state. Okay? So really, this big thing here is just star encoder this thing. Okay? So this original XREC sandwiched between an encoder and a decoder is this gate here. Okay? The point is we can take any decoded state, any synchron, put them into a star encoder, do this extended rectangle, and then decode, and that would be the same as doing this gate. That's how we figure out where that gate is.
What was the argument for the star decoder being unitary?
Well, because it is. It doesn't throw away any information. So remember this is an ideal decoder, so we don't have to worry about errors. So what you can do is think of it as a decoder. The decoder, you remember, puts the data in some qubit and has a bunch of other qubits left over. And those other qubits actually are the synchro, and they can tell us what error occurred and how to correct the decoded qubit. So it turned out that you can think about it and prove to yourself that actually there is always such an object that that decodes unitarily without kind of using any extra qubits in fact. Although if it did, I don't think that would really affect this. Okay? So anyway, we can do this for any rectangle, but of course we're only interested in doing it for the bad rectangles, so we don't want to replace the good rectangles by gates with errors. Okay, but the problem with doing this is that it introduced the star encoder. We don't immediately know what to do with the star encoder when we have a good extended rectangle. So we have to go back and apply the star encoder to the good extended rectangles. But luckily, if we have correctness for regular decoder, that implies correctness for the star decoder. So why is that? So correctness for an ideal decoder, what does that look like? We can replace the ideal decoders with star decoders that have discarded synchrons. So it looks something like this. It would be useful if I could just do that picture. No. Okay. And then we throw this away. Okay, so we know these two are equal. But this has to be true for all input states. Okay, and for that to be possible, that means that this ancilla that will be thrown away is, so the synchron is therefore not entangled at all, or correlated, in fact, with the output. At least when it's not correlated already on the input. Okay? And what that means is that the thing coming out here doesn't, that the thing coming out of here doesn't get changed at all by the presence of this syncope. Okay? So that implies what we like. And the syncope might get changed in the process of doing this gate. But that's okay. The point is it just doesn't get changed in a way that depends on the data given. Okay? And there's a similar statement for the truncated. Okay? So the upshot of this is that we're going to be able to do that argument that we had above, but now we use star decoders instead of ideal decoders. And that allows us to convert the good extended rectangles into ideal gates. And the bad extended rectangles into gates with errors, as we desire. Okay?
So the problem was that these errors that occurred in the because of the bad extracts, they are correlated to, they're no longer probabilistic.
Well, certainly they're... No. So the probabilistic part happened because they were bad, and that happens probabilistically. We'll get to that just in a second. But the problem is that the actual type of error that occurs in them is correlated, yes. That itself doesn't kind of violate our error model, right? We have these adversary error models. But the problem is the information that makes them correlated kind of got lost in this picture. Okay, so it's not that it was a fundamental problem, it's just that it was a problem with the formalism we were using, which is why we had to extend it just a little bit to keep track of the information that kept them correlated. And then it became true. Okay. So let's calculate now what the probability of having a bad extended rectangle is. Okay, I don't need something that draws that picture. I need something that erases reliably and accurately without leaving a blank chunk. Okay.
There's a block from the top.
Yeah, we'll have a fall. It's easier to erase with the eraser, but it's not as effective. Okay, so what's the probability of having a bad extended rectangle? Well, for bad extended rectangle, we need to have t plus 1 bad locations. So in particular, probably that a particular x-rect is bad. So Since we need t plus 1 bad locations.
At least 30.
Yeah, at least. So let's, if we look at some particular set of t plus 1 bad locations, then there's a probability p to the t plus 1 of having errors in a particular set. And that's regardless of what's going on in the rest of the extended rectangle. Right? If we just look at these particular t plus 1 locations, that's right. And so this is why we don't have to worry about more than t plus 1, because, well, anything that has more than t plus 1 includes a subset that has t plus 1. And how many of these sets of locations are there? Well, if there's A locations in the whole rectangle, in the whole extended rectangle, then there's A choose t plus 1 sets. So the probability of being bad is at most A choose t plus 1 times p to the t plus 1. Okay? And it's actually going to be a little less than that because there's some redundancy here, right? Because, if we have a set with t plus 2 bad locations, then we counted it multiple times because it has multiple different subsets of t plus 1. Okay? Yeah.
Bad means greater than or equal to t plus 1 bad locations. Right?
Yes, that was the definition. I see it under here.
So, for any, then you have to sum over all subsets of size greater than or equal to t plus 1.
Yeah, that's right. But the way I'm doing it is, if I did that, what I get would be the sum over all subsets, A choose size of subset, P to the size of subset, and then 1 minus P to the rest. Okay, so this actually is an upper bound on that sum. And the way I'm doing this is I'm saying, well, let's look at a particular set of t plus 1 bad locations. Probably the bad thing of having errors in all of those is p to the t plus 1, and then I'll use a union bound over all possible subsets of size t plus 1. Like I said, that's overcounting, but it is an upper bound. Okay? So let's look at a specific example. So let's look at the controlled knot extended rectangle for the 7-qubit code. Okay, so what does this extended rectangle look like? Well, we have error correcting steps on the incoming part. Then we do a transversal C knot. And then we do error correcting steps again. Okay, so we have 7 C0 gates and 4 error correction steps. So A in this case, so it's 7-qubit code, so t equals 1. So we're gonna have the probability of bad is A choose 2 p squared. So A, in this case, is going to be 7 plus B times 4, where B is the number of locations in an error correction step. Okay? So how many locations are in an error correction step? Well, we have to write the error correction step. That's a little more complicated. Let's go to this blackboard. Okay. So we're going to use Steen error correction. And so what we're going to do is we're going to prepare at silicubits in the state 0, logical 0. And I want to compare them with each other to check that they've been encoded correctly, because the encoded circuit is going to be non-volatile. So how am I going to do that? Well, so I think what I showed you last time involved comparing two of them and discarding them if they didn't agree. You can certainly do that. It means you have to do some kind of conditional probability. So just to make the calculation here a little bit simpler, I'm going to use three of them. And I'm going to do kind of repetition code. Oh, yeah, so that's a good point. So I'll get to that in a second. So right now, I just want to make sure that this is an encoded 0 and not an encoded 1. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a control mod from this one to this one and from this one to this one, and then measure both of these. And then based on these two, I can deduce whether this one's, assuming there's only one error in one of these encoding circuits, then if it's this one, these should both be 1. Right? And if it's this one or this one, then they'll disagree. And so we won't do anything because this one should be encoded 0. Okay. Now obviously, if there's an error in one of the physical gates here, that would be a problem too. But we're measuring these, right? We're getting the code word, the classical code word. So we can distinguish that from a case where there's a logical error. So we're going to take these two inputs and put them back here to see whether we have to correct the state. And meanwhile, so this block here is going to have to wait around while we're waiting for this measurement to happen, right, before we can correct. So there's going to be one wait step in here. Okay? So everyone see how this part works? Okay, so what about, before I, as Martin said, I used 4 actually, because I want to do phase error correction also, to check if there weren't too many phase errors here. But the 7-qubit code has this advantage that it's built out of 2 7-bit classical Hamming codes. And those are perfect codes. And so that means we can't actually ever have more than one phase error in a state. So we don't really have to worry about having multiple phase errors. And that's because there's no logical phase error here, right? A logical phase error acting on 0 is still 0. Now, if this were the logical 0 plus 1 state, then we'd have to worry about a phase error. But actually, then we wouldn't have to worry about a bit flip error. So. It turns out this is enough verification.
No, but
this is for the ancilla that we're using.
Yeah. But the zero bar, right, is just a superposition of all the state in C2 per, right?
Yeah.
So if you had a phase error, then you're going to have minuses in that superposition.
Absolutely. But a single qubit phase error is OK. What we're worried about is a block error, an error that has the wrong encoded state. Single qubit phase error is going to propagate to the data, or it's going to show up in the ancilla. I guess it'll show up in the ancilla there. That's not great, and we're not happy with that. But it's only a single qubit error, which is okay. The error correction sheet will still satisfy properties 1 and 2 if a single qubit error appears.
Sure, but what if there's 2 qubit error?
But remember, we're assuming that this is the 2 qubit code, right? So there's only going to be one error in this whole extended rectangle. So in particular, there can only be one physical error here. And 2 phase errors that appear in this 0 ancilla, like I said, that's equivalent to 1 phase error somewhere else. That's maybe not so obvious, but you can write it down if you like. It's a reflection of the fact that, the 7-bit Hamming code is perfect, that every state corresponds to a state with one error on it. You can go home and work it out. Okay. And then if it's wrong, then come back and tell me. Okay. And then we take that and use this as to do a transversal control knot to the data, right? And this is to correct phase errors. So we're going to then do a Hadamard here and measure. Okay? And then we do the same thing to detect bit flip errors, correct bit flip errors. So we're going to use the same ancilla preparation technique, or at least almost the same. But now we have to do now we actually want the ancilla to be 0 plus 1, right? Encoded 0 plus 1. So we do a transversal Hadamard here. And then we do a C naught here and right here. Okay, and then we take this information and this information and plug it back into the data and correct the error here. And there might be a wait step here while this waits around. Okay? So let's see. So first of all, let's notice here that while I've drawn it so that there's this big gap in between these two C naughts, we don't have to do that. Right? We can prepare these ancillas ahead of time so that they're ready exactly when we need them. Which means that the data doesn't have to wait around and they don't have to wait around. So similarly, for instance, while up here we do a control knot and another control knot, this one doesn't have to wait around for the first control knot because we just prepare it one step later so that it's ready just in time. Okay?
But then the second one would have to wait while I'm doing the...
Well, so this one would have to wait, except that it doesn't because we can measure it right away. We're done with it, right? All we need is now the classical information. Okay?
I was actually thinking that instead of the measurement and then having to wait and then applying it, why don't we do an encoded velocity?
Well, you could do that. The problem is the encoded Toffoli gate is a big deal. Right? It involves this other ancilla and more complicated thing. And a decoded Toffoli would be vulnerable to error. So, I mean, there's stuff you have to do there, but remember, it is important to decode the syncrome here so that you can distinguish between a single qubit error and a logical error. Right? You only want to correct a logical error here. But
this correction that we do to the upper ancilla or to the upper block is actually a quantum operation, right?
Yes, so this is a quantum operation. But it's controlled by classical data. Okay, and similarly over here. Yeah?
If we're tracking the probability of two errors, haven't we blown our error budget? Haven't we just say there's only going to be one error in this ancilla preparation?
So we are going to count the probability of two errors. But when there's two errors, we don't know what's going to happen. It could be arbitrarily bad. So what we want to say is that we do want a circuit though that when there's only one error, that works okay. Right? Because if one error could ruin it, that would be a real problem. Other questions? Okay, so let's count the number of locations in this error correction circuit. So let's see. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 transversal C knots. And each of them consists of 7 qubits, right? So that's 42 C knots. Numbers are only going to get larger. So single qubit gates, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And again, each of those could affect up to 7 qubits. Even the ones that aren't affecting up to 7 qubits, well, the other qubits have to wait around. So we have 35 single qubit gates. We have 1, 2, 3 wait steps, each of which you have 7 qubits waiting around. Measurements, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of those. Again, each of them affecting 7 qubits.
Then it would have saved on the multiplications.
Sorry? Yeah, well, that's true. yeah, I'm more concerned about saving on gates, but and actually you could save a lot of gates too, but this is just to get a simple example, to actually get a number out. But you made me lose track. Oh yeah, so what else do we have? So we have preparations. And I don't know how many gates there are in those, but there's six of them. Six preparations. So we're going to have to calculate that next. So what we have is a total of, so what do we call it? B is equal to, we have to sum these up. So what do we get? Maybe we could save on multiple.
20 to 7.
Is it, which way is easier?
140 plus 6 preparations.
140 plus, okay. Yes. And so C, of course, is the number of locations in the preparation. Okay? So let's do, what's the circuit for the zero encoder? And of course, it's going to be non-fault tolerant.
Are we going to get a threshold out of this?
Yeah, we are. That's why I'm doing it. So there's some logic behind this encoder, but I'm running a little short of time, so I'll skip that logic and just give it to you. So we have 7 qubits, 7 input qubits. 3 of them will start by doing Hadamards, and then we'll do a bunch of control knots to get the code words. And so we're going to break those up into 3 time steps. In the first time step, we do these 3 control knots. Okay, so from the 4th to the 1st, from the 6th to the 2nd, from the 7th to the 3rd, and then this qubit has to wait. And then in the second time step, we go from the 4th to the 2nd, and the 7th to the 5th. And then the 6th, the 1st. And the 3rd qubit has to wait. And then the last time step, we go from the 4th to the 3rd, and the 6th to the 5th, and the 7th to the 1st. And this qubit has to wait, second qubit. Okay, and the logic here is that basically each of these input qubits corresponds to one of the parity check matrices for the 7-bit Hamming code, and you do C knots to the, so for instance, the first row of the parity check matrix is 1, 2, 3, 4. And so this one is the 4th bit, and you do C knots to the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd qubits. So this started at 0 plus 1, and so these are just like a cat state kind of on those 4 qubits. But then it's you have to do something similar for the other ones. Okay, so anyway, so this is a zero encoder. And
is it possible to encode in some kind of fault-tolerant way where that would reduce?
Well, not really. Well, so it would reduce, maybe.
Yeah.
But you can't eliminate it altogether, right? Because it's an entangled state, so you got to do some control knots within the block.
Yeah, sure. But
so you can't really avoid that.
Is there sort of known generic techniques that will like reduce dramatically the number of errors? Or is just case by case?
Not systematically, I would say. So Panos Alfaris has looked at some related things. And actually, yet a more complicated thing where, well, there's certain types of errors that can occur here. And so you do some error correction procedure that kind of takes advantage of that to check those types of errors only and not having a full check of the state. But that's way beyond the scope of what I'm doing. But if you're really interested, you can do a part of it. Except I don't think you wrote it up, so it might be fine. I don't know. We can talk about that if that's what you're interested in.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Just a question.
So anyway, so let's count. So now this is all the physical qubits, right? These are zeros, not zero bars. So we don't have to do any of this multiplication by seven. We just count. We get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 C naughts. And 3 Hadamards. And 1, 2, 3 weight steps. Plus, we have to create 7 qubits in the beginning. So 7, 0 preparations. Okay, so what does that add up to? That adds up to 22. 21. 20. Oops, I added it wrong. Oh, because there's only 2 weight steps. So the reason we don't need this one is because this qubit doesn't do anything until this time step. So we can just prepare it in here. Okay, so that's a really small save. But anyway, I included it. So we have now C is equal to 21. Okay? And so that, assuming I did my calculations right at home, says that B is equal to 266. Yes. Okay? And then you quickly forget all the ugly calculations on this board, cover them up again, and don't cover them up too fast. B is equal to 266, which says that A is equal to, well, this I better look it up, it's 1071. Okay? And this tells us that this quantity, A choose 2, is 572,985. Okay? So that's a big number. Now, you can save this fair amount by doing some relatively minor optimizations well, maybe I should avoid covering this up until people have had a time to copy it all down. But you can save a certain amount on that by doing minor optimizations on these circuits. But this will at least give you a definite answer that we've gotten out of this. Okay? So any questions on that calculation?
How's this the probability then?
Oh, how's this the probability? So remember the error models in the assumptions about errors we're saying. So for each location, there's a probability p of having an error, and a probability 1 minus p of having no error. Okay? So just forgetting the whole thing about the adversarial error models, we can just consider those probabilities for how many locations in this big C0 extended rectangle have errors. So what's the probability of having no error? Well, that's 1 minus p to the number of locations. No errors anywhere involved. But it's still good if there's one error somewhere in this extended rectangle. So what we're interested in is the case of having 2 or more errors. So what's the probability of that? Well, by the argument above, it's at most a choose 2 times p squared. So if we have those point flips that tell us where the defaults are, this is the probability that we'll have a bad rectangle. Okay? So if we have a big circuit that consists of some good rectangles and some bad rectangles, what we would say, then we'd like to say, well, the probability of each rectangle being bad is this, and the probability of each rectangle being good is 1 minus L. Turns out that's not quite true, which is what we'll do in the remaining half hour. So I wanted to make one other point. I think I said this before. So this correctness definition is actually all we need, right? We don't need goodness. So what you can do is you can look at sets of errors that cause the correctness condition to fail and sets of errors that don't cause it to fail. So ones that don't cause it to fail, even if there's 2 or more errors in that set, that's a benign set. And the ones that cause it to fail, those are a malignant set. And so what you really need to do is not count the total number of apparent errors, but the number of malignant sets, or actually the probability of having a malignant set, right? Because they're different sizes. You should have to include 3 malignant sets that have 3 or 4 or whatever errors. Okay. And you, of course, you again only need to count kind of the minimal malignant set. Right? If you have 4 errors, but there's a 3-error malignant set, that's enough to count. So you count all of those. And then you can get a better number of that. But it's more complicated because you have to include higher order terms. Okay? So I'm not going to do that either. But it does allow you to get better numbers out of this.
So the corresponding number to 572,000 would be?
Well, basically, you lose an order of magnitude off of that. So it's 50,000 or something, a little less than that. And it's again, not quite like that, because then there's a PQ term as well. OK. So where do I want to put this? OK. So what we'd like to say is that if you have a big circuit, the probability of having a bunch of bad extended rectangles is, well, the probability of having one bad extended rectangle to the number of bad ones. Unfortunately, it's not true. Why is that not true? Well, because the probability of having bad extended rectangles is not independent between different extended rectangles, because they overlap. So if we have two rectangles like this, right, they overlap, and we have only three errors, say here, here, and here. Well, there's two errors in each of these extended rectangles, so they're both bad, even though there's only three errors. Right, we'd like it to be that you need four errors to get two bad extended rectangles. So this is indeed why the truncation was necessary.
Hallelujah.
Okay. So and the other thing that's important is that here, when we replaced the bad extended rectangle by some bad gate, we got rid of the whole extended rectangle, right? Including the error correction at the beginning, which was the trailing error correction for the preceding rectangle. So what we're going to do is, any rectangle that's followed by a bad rectangle, we're going to truncate it, get rid of the error correction. We're going to absorb that into the following bad rectangle. So that's our procedure. So starting from the end of the circuit, we truncate any extended rectangle that's followed by a bad extended rectangle. And if the truncated extended rectangle is not good, because it has fewer, we've lost maybe some of the errors. So if it had two, so in this case, for instance, this extended rectangle is bad. This one gets truncated, now it has only one error, so now it's good. So in that case, so if we had three of these things in a row, even though this one was bad by itself, the truncated version is good. So we don't want to truncate the next thing as well. Right? So it counts as good now. And that's why it was important to start at the end of the circuit, so that we have some systematic way of doing this. Yeah.
Then isn't the total number of XX which are bad would be like, I mean, will it accumulate the factor of two?
Yeah, but that's enough to cause serious problems, right? Because, we haven't talked about concatenation yet. But the problem is that if we're using error-correcting code that can correct one error, then we're supposed to have two errors to cause a problem. And if we lose a factor of two in that, then we're down to one error again, and we haven't gained anything by the error correction. So losing a factor of two, that would be serious, very, very serious. So there's another argument where you use codes that correct more errors, and you do lose that factor of two, but then you're not getting as good a threshold. You're getting even much worse than you can get out of this Bowser calculation.
But Daniel, I mean, this number already is like some large number, right?
Yeah. So you don't want to square it.
No, you just multiply by two.
No, you square it. Actually, it's more complicated than that. The problem is you have to go to bigger codes. You'd have to go to codes that are bigger than 7-qubit codes, so this number becomes much larger. And so it's not actually squaring it, but it's like a factor.
No.
Not sure, actually.
No, so
at least four, but.
So what I'm saying is that for a given X-ray, we know that the probability of it being bad is bounded by some number, right?
Yeah.
Right? And now, assume worse that, you know, when it is bad, the adjoining rectangle is also bad.
Yeah, yeah, but trust me, you don't want to do that. It's much better to do this. It makes the argument a little more complicated, but it doesn't make the numbers any worse. Whereas what you're doing, actually, the 7-qubit code, concatenate 7-qubit code, just won't work. I haven't gotten to concatenation yet, but I will in a minute. Okay? You'll have to trust me for the moment that that's not a good thing to do. I mean, you can get a result that way, but it's not far from ideal. Okay? So we've done this. And once we've done this, then we have a new arrangement of things that are good and bad, right? Some of them are truncated good, some are really good. Some are truncated and they're still bad, right? They might have had a lot of errors in it. So now what we wanted to do before. So what we can say, well, first of all, we can say, what's the probability of having some arrangement of good and bad extended rectangles? So now the probability of having multiple bad rectangles is bounded by the product of the probability that each is bad. Okay, so it's going to be less because some of them have gotten smaller, right? Because they've been truncated, there's fewer locations that they can have errors. Okay, but that's certainly not going to increase the probability of being bad. So we're safe if we think of the probability being bad as the probability of being a full extended rectangle being bad. And the result is we get something called level reduction. So if we have a fault-tolerant circuit, then using the types of arguments I've been talking about, we can replace it by a noisy unencoded circuit with errors bounded by probability P prime let's put in T here. So P prime is this thing we had before, A to T plus 1, P to the T plus 1. And A is the number of locations in the largest extended record. Okay, but in other respects, so when I say the error is bounded by this probability, so the errors will actually be correlated, right, because of this phenomenon I just said, and the errors, the different kinds of gates will have different error rates, right, because some extended rectangles are bigger than others, and therefore have a higher error probability. But we can bound it above by saying that the probability of error of each unencoded gate this way is going to be this. Okay? And you see that when p is small, this is going to be smaller. Right? So, like for the 7-qubit code, the probability of error, it turns out that the C0 gate is going to be the biggest extended rectangle, up to some assumption about the other rectangles. And so, you see, if p is less than 1 over that number, then p prime is going to be less than p. Well, I have to be more explicit about that, but I'll be able to do that in a second. Okay? But everyone understands the idea of this level reduction, right? So we use the arguments we said before. So we take this circuit. We at the end of it, we have measurements. If they're bad measurement rectangles, well, we replace them by bad measurements. An ideal star decoder followed by a bad measurement. If they're good, ideal star decoder followed by a good measurement, right? And then we sweep the star decoders back through the circuit, replacing bad rectangles by bad gates and good rectangles by good gates. We get the decoded circuit. And we know that the probability of having bad rectangles in a given place is at most p prime. Right, or at least, yeah, that's right. So it's bounded above by independent error model, independent probabilities of p prime. Okay? So it's maybe worth saying that this is where it's important. Well, this is kind of where it's important. The next step is where it's really important, that we use this adversarial error model version. Okay? So there's a lot of different ways in which this error model that we get out of this level reduction is adversarial. Because, for instance, here, the error could depend on the syndrome, right? It could be information from the previous thing. The fact that the gate errors are different rates, that's very mildly adversarial. The fact that these things are correlated between overlapping bad rectangles, that's really adversarial. Okay? So all of these things together tell us that even if we started with a completely independent error model, we're going to get something that's maybe not the full adversarial error model, but it's pretty complicated. Okay? And that's why it's nice to use it. Okay? Okay. So let's do the final step here. So what do we have? We have, so for t equals 1, we have that p prime is a choose 2 p squared. Okay? So let's let p sub t be 1 over a choose 2. And that means that we can rewrite this equation as p prime is p sub t times p over p sub t squared. Right? Because you get 1 over p sub t squared, so it's 1 over p sub t overall times p squared. And the point is that if p is less than p sub t, then this thing is less than 1. Right? And, So, one product of this is less than 1. So let's write this two ways. So this is one way. The other way is p sub t times p over p sub t. No, sorry, p times p over p sub t. Right? So if p over p sub t is less than 1, this thing is less than p. Of course, if p over p sub t is greater than 1, then the errors have gotten worse. But at least if the error rate is small enough, it's below 1 over that large number, then the errors get better by doing fault tolerance. So if they get better once, well, why not do it again? Right? And we can make them better even more, better by even more. And that's, in fact, what we do. So that's a procedure known as concatenation. So concatenation is something you can do just to error correct codes. And to do that, we take each qubit of a quantum error correcting code. And encode it again using another error correcting code. It could be the same one or a different one. And I have a problem on the problem set doing giving you more properties of concatenated codes. And for fault tolerance, it means we take a fault tolerant circuit and see how do I fix this. And we treat it as another circuit of physical qubits and gates. And so we go through this whole encoding procedure again. Right? And so now the code we're using is now a concatenated code. And the circuits are kind of concatenated as well. So each time we do this, we call this adding one level of concatenation. So this is why I was confused by Rahul's mention of level earlier on. And so as a convention here, we say level 0 is the physical qubits and the physical gates. And the top level, so level 0 the bottom level, the top level is the logical gates. Okay. Okay. So then, if we take an error correcting code, we concatenate. Or we take a fault tolerant circuit, concatenate again, concatenate again, concatenate again. We have a bunch of levels of concatenation. And each time we do this, the error rate undergoes this change. So it turns out what we get out of this is the threshold here. So this is one of the main, probably the main result about fault tolerance. What it says is that there's some threshold value, p sub t, which is going to turn out to be that p sub t, such that if p is less than p sub t, p the error rate per location, then we can perform arbitrarily long computations. So forth. That's not a mathematical statement. The mathematical statement is, if you want to achieve an error rate epsilon for logical location, so epsilon can be any and we can do this for any epsilon that's greater than zero. We need an overhead that's polynomial from the log of epsilon. And so overhead is the multiplicative blow up in the number of qubits. Number of physical qubits. Okay? So let's prove this theorem. Be very quick at this point.
So the error rate is we want the error rate to be small?
Well, certainly we always want the error rate to be small.
Right,
so in particular, if we have a logical computation that we want to do, we'd like the error rate to be at least 1 over the number of locations in that original. The logical error rate should be epsilon, should be 1 over the number of locations in that original circuit, so that there's a good chance of getting through it without having any logical errors.
So I guess my question is, we need overhead poly log of epsilon or 1 over?
Well, it's 1 over epsilon, I guess. Because log epsilon is less than 1, so log epsilon is negative. But, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I would guess that this overhead poly log, we see the actual calculated overhead depends a lot on the code you're using.
Yeah.
So is there some kind of maximal strategy? First level with this code, second level with another code?
Well, there's been a little bit of study on that, but not too much.
But is it like highly dependent on it, or?
The amount of overhead?
Yeah.
Well, depends whether you're interested in the asymptotic scaling as you get to very small epsilon, or kind of the actual constant numbers. But really, there hasn't been a whole lot of studies involved, so I'd be hesitant to make any definitive statement.
So when was this theorem coined in this particular form?
So this particular form, I mean, it doesn't make any reference to the codes you're using or anything. It just says that there is a threshold. So that dates back to 1996, actually. Yes. So at that time, there were a bunch of papers that three separate groups. So it's Nilla Flamenzer was one of them. Aharonov and Ben Orr was another, and Kataev was a third. And so they all stated this theorem. Some of them gave proofs. The proofs actually lost kind of this factor of two that Perl was mentioning. So they didn't use these overlapping extended rectangles. Well, they used different techniques. Let's put it this way. So this improved version, well, the specific proof I presented is a paper by myself, Hannes Holofernes, John Preskill from 2 years ago or something like that. That uses concatenated 7-qubit code. There's also another proof by Ben Reichardt that uses concatenated 7-qubit code. And that gets numbers which are better than that. But let me do this proof because it's really quick and we're running out of time. Okay, so the idea of the proof is just we apply level reduction. Repeatedly to concatenated code. Or at least a concatenated circuit. Okay? And so each time we do that, well, we're replacing the bad gates by physical gates with a new error rate. And so the error rate after removing j levels satisfies the following relation. It's p sub j. Well, we can use that formula, right? So it's p sub t times p sub j minus 1 over p sub t squared. Okay? And if you apply this twice, well, you see that this is equal to p sub t, p sub j minus 2 over p sub t to the fourth, right? Because we square and then we square again. And it turns out that the constants cancel out, so it's still of this form, which is why I wrote it this way. Okay? And if you do it again, well, it's not 4 anymore. It's now 4 squared, so it's 16. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. Okay? So what happens is we have a double exponential thing. So this turns out to be p sub t. So we take it all the way back to the first level, so it's p sub 0, which is p. So p sub t times p over p sub t to the 2 to the j. Okay, so we have a double exponential scaling here of error rate. So, okay, so to get p sub j equals epsilon, well, what do we need? Well, we need only j to be roughly log log of epsilon. So in particular, so we need 2 to the j is equal to log epsilon over pt over log p over pt. And maybe I should take 1 over these since these are both less than 1. But anyway, so this says that j is equal to log log, we'll take 1 over. So it's log log p sub t over epsilon minus log log p sub t over p. Okay? Of course, to actually calculate the overhead, well, j level concatenation, the overhead's going to be exponential in j. But luckily, that's nothing. I mean, who cares about exponential? We have a double exponential here to kill that. So we don't. It's not so bad. So the overhead is some number n to the j, which is going to be some polynomial in the log of 1 over epsilon as the matter. Okay? So it's worth noting that this number n here is bigger than the number of qubits in a block for the code, because we need lots of ancillas also. Right? So n is still fairly large here. But at least we don't need very many levels.
What was the n?
So the overhead that we need, so each qubit gets blown up into how many physical qubits, each logical qubit. How many physical qubits do we need for each logical qubit? So certainly we need to encode it. So each level of concatenation blows up by a factor of big N. That's what big N is. So what we need, to include in that big N, we need the error correcting code itself. So the 7-qubit code means a factor of 7. We also need all the ancillas we need for error correction and so on. And I haven't counted all of those out. It's some constant number, but it's much larger than 7. Okay? And so every time we add a level of concatenation, we get this extra factor of N. So we have N to the J, total overhead.
But what is the connection of n with, so there needs to be a connection of n with pt, right, to relate the two things?
Sorry, n with what?
N with pt, maybe?
Yes. I mean, but both n and pt are coming from this fault-tolerant circuit, the fault-tolerant circuits that we have for this code. So it's not that there's a trade-off between the two.
No, but
I mean, there is maybe, but it's all based on, you look at some error-correcting code, you write down some fault-tolerant circuits for that. And those will give you N, they'll give you PT.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, so N is a constant.
N is a constant in terms of J and epsilon, yes. So if you use a different error correcting code and a different set of fault tolerant circuits, you could have a different N and a different PT.
Yeah, but it's a constant.
Yeah.
So you're saying to j is like that, then you're just saying constant to the j is poly log.
That's right, because j is log log. Okay? Yeah?
I mean, it's
so,
minus sign. I don't
think it's minus sign. Yeah, so sorry. So I took the log. So I said we need pj equals epsilon. So take the log of both sides.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we get log of epsilon over pt divided by log of this is 2 to the j. Take the log again, and we get this. So I flip these because if you flip this and this, that's two minus signs, right? Log of 1 over x is minus log x. That was the only really non-trivial. I mean, this is just... Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let me just quickly put in a number or two. So going back to the calculation, as I said, the C0 gate turns out to be the worst rectangle for the 7-qubit code. Although there is a competition, right? There's the pi over 8 rectangle, so you have to do some clever stuff to make it better than the C0 gate. But so what this tells us is that P sub T is greater than 1, greater than or equal to 1 over that number, which turns out to be 1.7 times 10 to the minus 6. A little bit more than that, actually, but it's a lousy number anyway. Okay? So if you have an error rate below that, then we know that using concatenated 7-qubit code, you can do arbitrary long computations. So it turns out you can get better threshold estimates. So for the 7-qubit code, using the various tricks I mentioned and some that I didn't, you can get a threshold about 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5. So it turns out there's some more advanced techniques, which I probably won't have time to go into, that use really huge Ancilla factories. And so using those, the best proofs get a threshold that's around 10 to the minus 3, 1 in 1,000. And actually, there are simulations that give a threshold which, believe it or not, is of the order of 5 or 6%. Okay. So to do this, you have to go to a much looser error model where you don't have these adversarial errors. You just have, say, the polarizing channel on these gates.
So all that, right, is saying, assuming that you have your error rate is lower than that, and assuming you have an infinite amount of fresh answers.
No, a finite but large.
Yeah.
Polylog large. So it's asymptotically for really, really long computations.
Yeah, okay, but it does assume that, you ask for an insula here.
That's right. And assuming a whole bunch of other things, the stuff I had on the first couple of boards.
It's mostly insula.
Then you can do arbitrary long computation.
And of course, you're going to need the arbitrarily long time to do these things.
No, so I didn't say what the time glove is, but the time glove is also polylogarithmic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So what happens when you do one level of concatenation for fault tolerance? Well, you replace each gate by a fault tolerant gate, you replace, and then you add these error correction steps, right? So the time blow-up is some constant that depends on the fault tolerant circuit, which is actually not that large. I mean, if you look at, if you look at Steen error correction, it's only like 4 time steps there for the data. Right? So the time blow up is actually not that large. And so each time you blow up, you do one level, you have a constant time blow up. And so the time blow up is also some constant to the J, which is then poly log J.
Right, it's constant to the J. Why is it not N?
Well, N is a space blow up. Right? So it's just a different quantity.
Okay.
I don't understand.
N was not the expansion that each, when you encode each gate, then it just becomes n times.
No, n is the number of qubits that you need when you encode one extra level. Qubits in the code, in the ancillaries. The qubits, number of qubits you need simultaneously.
So
n is the width blow up, and we have some other constant for the time blow up.
Yeah, so the time blow up is like a.
The time blow up is not like a. No, a is the number of locations, not the depth. But roughly speaking, maybe A is n times the depth blow. Roughly speaking. Again, because of this C naught is one location. But
again, you count in time, it's just the
depth. Yeah. So in this case, time and depth are the same. So it's just because, it's a physics institute here. So I call it time rather than depth.
No, but Daniel, I mean, this is like... If there is a huge circuit which is just depth one, then you will say that it's like
that's right. That's right.
But in the classical complexity, that's not right.
It is if you're talking about parallel computation. Right?
The simulation mentioned there, does it involve only one graph class computation?
Sorry, which simulation?
The simulation that is the 5 to 6%.
No. So this, well, no, so that also uses concatenation, but it uses some more complicated procedure to get the ancillas that you use.
Right.
So it's not completely self-similar.
Right, in other words, it does not take into account the correlation that can possibly take into the situation by level. Not only it has a
weaker correspondence. No, it does. It does, actually. I mean, it does in a different way. Well, maybe I can explain to you later exactly what's going on. Yeah.
Then, so here, this threshold theorem seems to state in a manner in which it's saying that there are no assumptions at all. I mean, you can
So obviously there are assumptions. I implicitly everything I was saying today was based on the assumptions that I wrote at the beginning.
Yes.
And as I said, next time we'll talk about if those assumptions are really necessary to get a threshold limit or not.
So we really don't have a. A threshold theorem with no assumptions.
No, of course not. This is, again, you can discuss this next time. If you don't have any assumptions, the threshold theorem is not true. But that's really a weak thing to say, that there are no assumptions at all.
No, assumptions meaning you will have an assumption, of course, a bound on the error.
Yeah, no, but if you don't have any assumption about correlation of errors, for instance, there's no threshold theorem.
And also that when the error occurs, when it doesn't occur, it's...
Well, we can discuss this next time. This is what I want to do next time. I want to discuss which of the assumptions are necessary, which ones are not. Right? And again, problem sets, turn in your problem set, pick up a new one.